This is about the latest start we've gotten all semester. Okay, we were talking about detectors last class, and I mentioned these characteristics. I won't go over them again, but relevant characteristics for detectors. And I mentioned the photoelectric effect. We talked about the phototube based on the photoelectric effect and a primitive phototube. I showed you a picture here. We talked about the photomultiplier tube, very important, and this is really where we are because I didn't finish the photomultiplier tube. I showed you these pictures and handed around a photomultiplier tube, a couple of photomultiplier tubes, and real workhorse. More photomultiplier tubes are used as detectors probably than anything else, and they still have a huge market share, you might say. They when it comes to instruments and detecting light, photomultiplier tubes are king. Okay, we went through various characteristics that a manufacturer might specify for a photomultiplier tube, like quantum efficiency, cathode sensitivity gain, and spectral response, and I mentioned dark current. And this is where we're going for today, where we're going to pick up today, is in this area of dark current. Dark current is the current that is produced even when the photomultiplier tube is operated in darkness. Now, if you don't operate the photomultiplier tube, it's not going to do it, not going to give you a signal. What does it mean to operate? You apply the voltage, okay? You've got to apply voltage. Sometimes it's referred to as the high voltage, 90 to 100 volts on each of the successive dynodes. So we apply the voltage, but we got it in the dark. No photons coming in. But some current is still produced because I mentioned there's this hyperactive photocathode. The photocathode that is exhibiting the photoelectric effect gives off some thermionic emission. It's mentioned on the next slide, I guess. Thermionic emission, which means just because of the ambient temperature at which the photomultiplier tube and that photocathode is being held, it gives off gives off some light. So it gives off an electron because of this energy that's trapped due to the temperature. Okay, so this is where dark current comes. Okay, or this is thermal dark current. Zoom slideshow, thank you. And it's temperature dependent. I said we cool the photomultiplier tubes around negative 40 degrees C. Fairly expensive, right? Because you have a whole cooling system developed or built for your instrument. It's going to be large, bulky, time-consuming, not so convenient. But if you really need to have low dark current, now dark current is going to be the lowest level of current that you're going to get from your photomultiplier tube. Therefore, you're not going to be able to measure signals lower than that. So it's going to define your detection limit, basically, of your system based on that dark current that's coming off of the photomultiplier tube. Okay, so if it has a smaller work function, if the photocathode has a lower work function, it's going to give you more dark current. It's going to be easier. Lower work function means it's easier to pull those electrons away from the photocathode. Therefore, they're going to be more spontaneous, more spontaneously emitted, and therefore you're going to have more dark current. So red-sensitive photocathodes, which respond to low energy, are also going to give you probably higher dark current. Couple of things here. It says if you expose the photocathode to bright daylight without power, so you don't even have the voltage on it. Let me just tell you, if you expose the photomultiplier tube to bright light with the power on, you pretty much ruin it. Okay, it's meant to measure low light levels. It's meant to measure photons. Okay, not hundreds of watts of room light. Okay, so you're blinding it if you were to operate it in the daylight or in room light, power on, nothing shielding it. Now, what happens in a typical instrument, typical UV visible instrument, you open up there's a little cover, right, and you open up the the lid to put your sample cuvettes in, and there's a shutter. Okay, that lid, when you open it up, there's a shutter that falls down in front of the photomultiplier tube to prevent bright light from getting in. Some instruments actually have a switch that turns the power off. That's not a good idea because the photomultiplier tube needs to warm up and come to some equilibrium, and if you're shutting it on and off, that equilibrium is going to be disturbed. So it's better just to cut the light off, to have a mechanical shutter. So you open the door and a little shutter falls in front of the photomultiplier tube to prevent it from getting room light or bright light on it. So you never want to operate a photomultiplier tube in daylight or in bright sunlight or room light, with the power on, operate it at all, ever. Okay. Now we're talking about putting it in bright light when it's turned off. So I'm taking this photomultiplier tube and I'm leaving it sit around in the room, or I'm putting it on the windowsill where the sun shines on it. And what happens is the photocathode traps some of the energy and it gets noisy. So if I plug the thing in and go to use it, I'm going to find out that I'm getting a high noise level. I'm getting a high dark current because of that trapped energy from leaving it sit on the windowsill or leaving it exposed to bright light. I can fix that problem by operating it, in other words, putting voltage on it for 24 to 48 hours, keeping it in the dark, and then the thing comes back, the photocathode and the photomultiplier tube comes back to an equilibrium and it operates normally. Okay. Long-term exposure to bright light leads to sensitivity loss, particularly at the longer wavelengths. The wavelengths where they're lower energy and where you get response from materials that have a lower work function. Noise due to random fluctuations. Okay, so general noise in photomultiplier tubes. Okay, so we're talking about PMT noise. And actually, I should make this, the discussion, I'm going to give you a discussion that's more general. So let me erase that and say, I'll give you a general noise discussion. So we're talking about noise in any electronic circuit. Now, again, most detection systems are photomultiplier tube detection systems. When we're talking UV visible absorption, fluorescence, things like that, it's photomultiplier tubes. There are other kinds of detection systems. We'll talk about those in a few minutes. But I'm going to give you a general discussion of that circuitry and the kinds of noise that you're going to get. So there's three major sources of noise in electrical circuitry, like the circuitry that we get, any kind of detection circuitry that would be used for a photomultiplier tube, for example. So here we've got electron noise, which is called shot noise. I'll describe these in a little more detail. Johnson noise, which is thermal motion of conducting electrons. And then quantum noise, which is photon flux. Okay, it's due to the photon flux. So three sources of noise. And so shot noise. Shot noise is, it says, I guess I didn't define it as well here. Okay, yeah, electron current. Okay, so you go over to electrical engineering, they'll tell you. You got an electron current. We're generating a current because we've got electrons coming off of the photocathode and then the dynodes and all that, and we're generating this electron current. But there is noise in that. It's not, some kind of a variation of the electron current, and it's referred to as shot noise, and it's proportional to the square root of the signal. So the more signal, the more noise, but it's not a linear response. It's not a directly proportional. It's proportional to the square root. Shot noise is the main noise that you have, except if you're at very low currents. So most of the time, in an electronic circuit that we have for a detection system, like we would use with a photomultiplier tube, most of the time, shot noise is the biggest source of noise that you have, okay? And it's just due to this electron current that's flowing in the system. Now, this equation here describes that in detail. you've got a current, okay, that's flowing in the system, and there's no some current level, maybe a low level, maybe it's a high level. Superimposed on that current level is noise, okay, random fluctuations that are occurring by this process we're referring to as shot noise. That noise current, which is defined here, I noise, it's related to this the current that we're measuring, the base, the actual current that's flowing, but we're only interested in the noise current. So it says here, it's equal to 2 times E, which is the charge on an electron, okay, because we're talking about electrons and the noise that the electrons are creating. There's a signal current, so the signal current is part of this, but remember we said it's the square root, so the whole thing's raised to the one-half power. So it's not directly proportional, shot noise is not directly proportional to current that's flowing, but it's proportional to the square root of that current. And then the last concept here, the last term, is delta F, not to be concerned with any of the other, not to be confused with any of the other Fs that we've talked about, you know, focal length and a function of and F number and what else? Focal point, I don't know. Anyway, delta F here is the bandwidth of the detection system. Now, bandwidth. We talked about bandpass. It's a related concept. If I have a detection system, an electronic circuit, and we're not talking wavelengths of light or anything, we're talking like, you know, who is it? Comcast? Broadband? You know, whatever. Okay, that's what we're talking about. Comcast runs a cable to your house, and it's broadband. There's a wide band of information or signals that are coming over that cable, that coaxial cable that comes to your house. Cable has a bandpass. It's a very broad bandpass, or at least that's what they would have you to believe by their advertisements, okay? So that means I can put on that cable, I can put, you know, television signals, radio signals, I can put on their telephone, right? You can have your telephone on there, I can have my computer signals. Why? Because I'm using different regions of the overall broad band for different signals. So I got my TV up here, my radio, my computer, my telephone. Okay, I've got the broad band of this system divided up into different segments where I am going to put different information. Well, in a detection system that we use for a UV visible spectrophotometer that we have a photomultiplier tube plugged into, we have some bandpass or some bandwidth of signals that are flowing in that circuitry. We are going to have the current is going to have some bandwidth. It's not going to be broadband. Okay, it's simpler than broadband that comes across into your home by cable. But it has a bandwidth, and that bandwidth means that's the range of frequencies over which the the electronic signals that are flowing in that circuit, over which they vary, okay, over which that signal varies. So there's a delta F, there's some range over which we're going to have signals that we're interested in. Remember I talked to you about ELF. You don't remember what ELF is. I should put that on the exam. ELF. What's ELF? Extremely low frequency radiation. Right, the 60 hertz signal that comes through the building. Right, if we could see radiation, if we could see electromagnetic radiation other than the visible region, we wouldn't be able to see. We're surrounded by signals. Right, we're surrounded by frequencies. Extremely low frequency radiation that comes from the 60 hertz wiring in the building isn't of any use to us, okay, when it comes to detection systems. As a matter of fact, it could be a interference, right? We don't want the 60 hertz signal that's in the wiring in the building to interfere with our measurement system. So, but these are all bands or frequencies of radiation that help us to understand the bandwidth of the detection system that we have. If you were to use a detection system to measure kinetics. Okay, you're going to do some kinetic experiments. And the kinetics are fast. They're millisecond kinetics. No, let's make a microsecond kinetics, okay? Really fast kinetics, all right? Well, you better have a detection system that will measure that. Well, photomultiplier tubes will. As a matter of fact, they have response times we'll mention in a few minutes. Nanosecond response times, okay? So my detection system and the currents flowing in my detection system have some bandwidth. They have some range over which they're typically going to vary. That plugs in to my noise equation, because the frequency of my noise is what I'm interested in. So this is the equation, okay? This is the equation for shot noise, and bandwidth is about the only thing that you probably may not be regularly familiar with. All the other stuff is pretty common, right? Charge on electron, current, two is still two, okay? All right. Okay. All right, so I didn't say anything about the other kinds of noise, did I? Yeah, okay, I didn't. Let me back up and say something about thermal noise, okay? Otherwise known as Johnson noise. Any circuit that has current flowing in it, all right, what happens? It gets warm, right? You get current flows through a resistor. You know, the system has resistors and capacitors and all these different electronic components. Well, when we say we turn something on and let it warm up, why do we do that? Because it actually does get warm. It actually does warm up, and then a lot of electrical circuits will have heat sinks, things that will draw heat off of the electrical circuit and dissipate it to the air around it. So you turn it on, sometimes an instrument, you turn it on and you let it warm up for a half an hour or so, so everything, all the electronics get warm. Well, that warmth, okay, creates noise, because as things heat up, we get motion of electrons in the circuit that is caused by heat, or it's referred to as thermal motion of the conducting electrons in the load resistor. Well, what's the load resistor? The load resistor is anything in the electrical circuit that is a resistance, that takes some energy for the electrons to flow through them. So we usually refer to them, all of the resistances in a system, as the load. And it takes a certain amount of power to operate this load, okay, this whatever the burden of resistance is in the entire circuit. Well, the fact that they get warm and the electrical circuit gets warm and causes motion of those electrons that are flowing through there, that causes noise. It's not as big a noise as the shot noise, because we already said that shot noise is the most predominant form of noise, except when you're at really low current levels. Right? So we've got shot noise, we've got Johnson noise, and the third one, the quantum noise, is just the statistical variation of the photons coming in. Okay, now, at high light levels, who can tell the difference? It's just photon after photon. Billions and quadrillions and whatever comes after that, you know, Googleplex or something, okay? These huge numbers of photons coming in, and you can't barely tell the difference. We're going to see in a minute that if we get a really low light levels, okay, photons, you can count the photons. One photon, there it went. Two photons, okay? We can count the photons, and we find out that they don't come in at evenly spaced intervals. It's like traffic, right? You know, out on the highway, the cars are driving. Sometimes there's bunches of cars. Sometimes there's no cars. There's some kind of statistical variation, right? At night, at 5 o'clock or early in the morning, and sometimes there's a continuous line of traffic. You're stuck in it. But that's when there's high light levels, and the photons are just flying in, and you can't tell that there's any variation. But you get at really low levels, and you begin to see that there are variations, that they come. Sometimes several come, sometimes none. And so there's a variation. So quantum noise is the statistical variation of the photons coming in. Again, this is something you got no control over. It's the light level that you're trying to measure in most experiments that we're going to do. But it's a source of noise. Okay, so we have those sources of noise. I'm going to wrap up photomultiplier tubes with, I think I have maybe three or four slides left. Let me just say first, advantages. There are many advantages of photomultiplier tubes. They're very stable, except if you screw up. End of story. No, except if you mess up and expose them to high light levels. Okay, so don't, you know, be careful with your photomultiplier tube when it's operated. You know, don't carry around like I do. Okay, this is for your edification, for you to see and learn from. But typically, if you have this photomultiplier tube, you keep it in the box. Okay, you keep it in the drawer, and when it's operated with voltage on it, you at all costs keep high light levels away from it. Photomultiplier tubes are sensitive because of the multiplying effect, the fact that we have all those dynodes and we can and get a great increase in signal. What I showed you before, a factor of a million is not uncommon. Okay, a 1,000,000-fold amplification is not uncommon. So they're sensitive. They have the great advantage of being linear over several orders of magnitude. So they have a wide dynamic range. In other words, the range of current versus signal. Okay, the applied signal and the current that they produce. So the light levels that produce a certain current gives you a nice linear response. Right? That's a good thing. All right, so many orders of magnitude. Cost is good. Okay, this kind of a photomultiplier tube's a couple hundred bucks, maybe. I haven't bought one in a while, but something like that. If you need to do anything special, you want to do UV work, you got to have a quartz envelope around it. That might increase the price. If you want to do red sensitive, you need a photomultiplier tube that's sensitive to low energy light, you know, red end of the spectrum, then you might pay a little bit more. But, you know, basic photomultiplier tube, not too expensive. They do have long lifetime, 20 years, you know, whatever. I mean, it lasts a long time. The components are good. Sometimes if they lose the vacuum, then they're no good. So that often is the case. Sometimes a component burns out. Let's see, rapid response. I mentioned to you a minute ago, nanoseconds, right? 10 to the minus 9th seconds. This is going to be important because in fluorescence, we can measure lifetimes of a fluorescent process. The lifetimes of many fluorescent processes are on the nanosecond time scale. Phosphorescence is longer, millisecond. Even on the second scale, phosphorescence. You know, your glow-in-the-dark keychain. Okay, that's phosphorescence. Okay, it glows in the dark for a while. So it has photomultiplier tubes have no problem measuring photo effects, photophysical effects that are nanosecond or longer. Now, picosecond, they can't do it. Okay, picosecond time scale is too short, and there are lifetimes in fluorescence that are picosecond lifetimes, and you have to use a different type of a detector to do that. You have to use an electron multiplier, which is what's often used in mass spec, okay, mass spectrometry, electron multipliers. Fast response, okay, fast response. Kinetics, I mentioned before, kinetics. Millisecond, microsecond time scale, no problem. I don't know, I'm not a kinetics guy, but I don't know many chemical reactions just because of the molecules have to come together to react. I don't think they happen faster than the microsecond time scale. So photomultiplier tubes are fine for all that kind of work, right? It's because of their fast response. It says here, IR detectors are not nearly as good as photomultiplier tubes. I'll talk about IR detectors hopefully by the end of class. I may not finish with that. I'll finish maybe that next class. But infrared detectors, IR radiation is not energetic enough to cause the photoelectric effect. Okay, there is not photosensitive material that when you shine a little bit of IR light on it gives off an electron. The process requires too much energy, so when it comes to IR, you can't use photomultiplier tubes at all. So you have to use a different kind of detector, and we'll talk about some of those detectors in a few minutes. Let me just mention that there is a technique using photomultiplier tubes for low light level measurement, low light level detection, and that's called photon counting. And I've got a couple slides here to describe for you photon counting. So I mentioned it already. The idea is when I get really low light levels, okay, I've got light levels down in that are approaching my dark current. Remember, the photomultiplier tube has some dark current. Even if I cool it, I'm going to have some dark current. You'll notice in my slide where I said if we cool the photomultiplier tube to minus 40 degrees C, that gets rid of most of the thermal component of the dark current. Most, not all. Okay, so you're always going to have some dark current with a photomultiplier tube. If I want to measure low light levels, I'm doing an experiment and I need extremely low sensitivity. I got to get way down to low concentrations, and therefore I'm going to have very small amounts of photons that I've got to measure. My current generated by my photomultiplier tube, even with the multiplication effect, gets down to the neighborhood of my dark current. So now my ability to make the measurement or to distinguish real signal current from dark current becomes a problem. And I get into this technique, and the way to solve that problem is to use this technique called photon counting. So normally what we're measuring is the DC level of the current. We're just set up a circuit. We get current to flow because we shine light on the photomultiplier tube. It generates current. We get current flowing in a circuit. We measure that current. That tells us how much light, or it's proportional to the amount of light. When I get down to low light levels, I'm not measuring the DC current anymore. What I'm going to do is I'm going to measure the fact that every photon that comes in and strikes the photocathode and generates an electron, a photoelectron, which is then multiplied by the successive dynodes, each photon that comes in generates a pulse of electrons. And that's what this little diagram is meant to describe. So if I'm looking in the microsecond time scale, I'm stretching out my time scale, I'm really fast here, and I'm looking for the intensity of light, but there's not a steady state intensity of light. There's pulses at the microsecond time scale, pulses of electrons. The first pulse that comes through is a big pulse due to a photon striking the photocathode and all the successive dynodes creating electrons. Then a little dinky pulse comes through. What's that all about? I don't know. Must have been a mistake. Okay. Then another big pulse comes through. Yeah, that's a light signal. Okay, and another big pulse comes through. And then another little dinky pulse. Okay. Now, as I've labeled them here, the big pulses are the signal pulses because of photons. The little pulses are dark current pulses, just spontaneous, hyperactive photocathode spitting off electrons. By the way, that term hyperactive, it has really nothing to do with chemistry, science. Okay, I just threw it in there because everybody knows, you know, somebody who's hyperactive. And when I was a kid, I was hyperactive. Okay? All right. So there's dark current pulses and there's signal pulses. The dark current pulses are typically small pulses. The signal pulses would be larger pulses. So I get my electrical engineer buddies down there who allow me to do all this stuff. Okay, I'm not into building circuitry. I get somebody to help me with that. And so I go to the electrical engineers and they've allowed me to view the current in my system on the microsecond time scale, and they're going to set me up with what's called a discriminator. Okay, a discriminator is a device that comes in and says, "I'm going to discriminate. I don't like short pulses. Okay, I like tall pulses. Right? So I'm going to be a snob, and I'm not going to count the short pulses. I'm only going to count the tall pulses. Right? So I know I set my discriminator at some level where I think." Okay, there's a little bit of thinking going on here, okay, something you got to add in here. You got a little intuition, and I'm going to say, here's the level. If the pulse is bigger than this, it's a signal pulse. If it's smaller than this, it's a dark current pulse, and I don't even want to know about it, all right? And this is how photon counting works. So I got a counting system, almost like you would count radioactive decay think about it, it's a very similar concept. If I have a radioactive sample, if the radioactive sample has just a small amount of radiation coming out of it, a few disintegrations per second, small numbers of disintegrations per second, well, on the microsecond time scale, those are pulses of whatever. If it's beta, if it's a beta decay, it's electrons. So if it's an alpha decay, it's a helium nucleus, right? But whatever it is that's coming out, it comes out in some time frame. And now you say, well, what's the problem with radiation? You have cosmic radiation coming from the sun. Yeah, we're being bombarded by cosmic radiation from the sun all the time. If I have a radioactive detector, I've got to distinguish between the decay of my radioactive sample and the background cosmic radiation that's coming from the sun or that's coming from the exit signs in the building. Did you know that this, I think maybe they've replaced them all. The exit signs in the building have tritium in them. It's a radioactive isotope of hydrogen, right? And not small amounts either. Significant amounts, right? Because the university is too cheap to buy lighted exit signs. So they buy them with tritium in them, okay? There was a move to replace them because, radiation's coming out of things. So, but there's radiation coming from everywhere. You know, the glow-in-the-dark watch dials, they used to put radium in there. People got cancer from, they used to hire people to paint watch dials. And what they did was they'd take the paintbrush and they'd put it on their tongue or their lip to get a nice sharp point on the end of the paintbrush, and then they'd paint the dials with radium, with paint that had radium in it. And what were they doing? They were getting lip cancer and mouth cancer from paint. But there's radiation everywhere, right? There's radioactivity all over the place. And so you've got to distinguish between your sample and that radiation. Okay, forget the radioactivity for a minute. Now let's talk about photon counting. I've got the same exact situation. I'm counting the process, the electron pulses that are coming from my photons coming in. And I've got to discriminate. And I've got to discriminate between signal pulses and dark pulses. How do I know? Okay? Educated guess. Okay? Educated guess. Again, the electrical engineers have brought this thing to a science. When you buy a photon counting system, it will have on it several adjustments, several knobs, several controls that will allow you to set the discriminator. Sometimes they'll have two discriminators, high-level, low-level discriminators, and they'll have some other things I'm going to talk about in just a minute that will help you to refine this measurement of photon counting. All right. So hopefully you understand, based on this diagram, what I'm talking about. Here's a block diagram of the system. It's your photomultiplier tube. All photomultiplier tube systems are going to have some kind of an amplifier in it. You're going to boost the signal, all right, and stabilize the signal. And then you have your discriminator in there that looks for the pulses, okay, looks for the height of the pulses, and then a counter that just counts the number of light pulses, or now it's electron pulses. They've been converted to electron pulses. Discriminator sets the level for counting. Pulses exceeding the discriminator level are counted. Pulses below the discriminator level are not counted. Basic, very simple. By the way, I don't say much about this, but on the website, okay, where all these slides are and all the lecture materials are and all the video and audio and all this stuff, okay, there's handouts, right? And if you actually read some of those, there's one there on photon counting. There's at least one on photon counting. It goes in a little more depth, not a lot more depth, a little more depth than what I'm telling you in class. And they're all, it's light reading. Most of it's light reading. A couple of the electrochemistry things I gave you were they were actually papers that were, 10 pages long. But most of the handout material is 2 pages, 3 pages, 4 pages long. Light reading. Something, you have insomnia? Read that stuff. It'll put you right to sleep. Okay, couple of terms. Dead time and dead time loss. In between pulses. A pulse of electrons, a photon comes in, generates a pulse of electrons. My system measures a pulse of electrons. After that pulse comes through, the electronics have to recover. The pulse goes up. That's what you're measuring, the current pulse that goes up. The electronics have to get back down to the baseline level so they can measure the next pulse. We're talking microsecond time scale. If another pulse comes in too quick, it misses it. Was that a pulse? Okay, it just goes by, and it doesn't know. It misses that pulse because the electronics haven't recovered adequately to count the next pulse. So there's a problem here. If I get to too high a light levels, the pulses are coming fast. Boom, 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 right? They're coming in. Was that one pulse or two? You know, they flew in too close together, and so I've got a problem. So it says, after each pulse, electrons need some time to recover. That's referred to as the dead time, the time in which nothing's happening. It won't even count. The electronics are dead as far as pulses are coming through. And if a pulse arrives during the dead time, they won't be counted. And that dead time is 0.1 to 0.01 microseconds. Okay, so, you know, we're talking sub-microsecond time scale here, but the electronics need, you know, some time to recover. Now, again, back to my friends, the electrical engineers, they know how fast, they've characterized their electronics that they built. And so what they do is they say, we can predict, because we've characterized the system so well, we can predict what the loss in signal will be due to the dead time. And we call that dead time loss. Amazing how that works. So we name things, you know, so it really tells you what it's all about. So dead time loss, so if I have low light levels and I get a pulse, and then one microsecond later another pulse comes, that's no problem. If I get 10 pulses in a microsecond, I might start to have a problem because that's on the 0.1 microsecond range. Or if I get 100 pulses in a microsecond, that might be a problem. So the electrical engineers tell me that at some level of pulses, we can tell you what you're losing, just sort of on a statistical average basis. If the pulses are coming in really fast, if your current levels or your signal levels are of a certain value, we can tell you approximately, pretty close, what the dead time loss is going to be. So you'll find that when you buy a photon counting system, one of the controls, one of the settings on the photon counting system is dead time loss. And it'll tell you, if you press a button, it will fix the dead time loss. It'll say, your signals are getting up to, what does it say here? 10 to the 5th to 10 to the 6th counts per second. They'll make an automatic adjustment, boosting the signal to account for the dead time loss. But again, you're in control, hopefully. You, as the all-knowing, all-seeing, chemist, need to understand how the photon counting system works and be able to know, I'm getting into a level where the signals are too high for photon counting. I ought to just go to normal DC current levels and measure the current from the photomultiplier tube and not worry about photon counting. That's only for really low light levels. Somewhere in between, I can get my electrical engineering people to tell me that they've built into their device their photon counting system that we can adjust for the dead time loss. But that's not going to work at really, really high levels. You might as well just measure the DC current. Okay, so photon counting is a low light level technique, and then at normal high levels, high light levels, we measure DC current, and then in between we might have to worry about dead time loss and so forth. Okay, upper limit of intensities measured by photon counting is determined by is dictated by dead time loss. Let me just show you this diagram, which I borrowed from Scoogan West. The book that the undergraduates use. It's a plot of number of pulses, okay, versus pulse height. So, dark current, no illumination. Okay, no illumination is this curve. Okay. Constant illumination, light turned on, is this curve. Now, what's it trying to show me? It's trying to show me that if I set my discriminator level too low, okay, if I set my discriminator level down here, right, I'm going to, back to my other diagram. Where was my other diagram? If I set my discriminator level too low, way down here, see, I got it set up here right now. But if I set it down here, what's going to happen? I'm going to count this pulse, and I might even count this pulse as well as these. Well, that's too low. Okay, I'm going to get erroneously high numbers because I'm counting dark current. I'm counting things that I don't want to count. By the way, if I set my discriminator too high, I get nothing. I don't count anything. Okay, so this little thing has a little animation for you. Okay, so if I push right in here is probably where I want to be. Okay, right in here is where I want to operate. If I push the discriminator setting too high, my constant illumination counts starts to fall off. If I set my discriminator level too low, my dark current counts start to go up. I don't want to get dark current, and I don't want to lose constant illumination pulses. So I want to be somewhere in the middle, maybe in this range, maybe somewhere in here. There's a little leeway there for you. You know, you can operate probably anywhere in here and get decent data. All right. So that's the whole deal behind photon counting. Okay. Any questions about counting photons? You ever watch Sesame Street? Okay. Then there's a guy named the Count. One photon, two photons. Anyway, okay. Photomultiplier tubes. We spent a lot of time on them, but they're very important. Again, most UV visible instruments are going to have a photomultiplier tube. Some are not. Some are going to have what we call image detectors. Okay, image detectors are, as it says here, powerful detectors used instead of photomultiplier tubes to detect all of the spectrum or part of the spectrum. Now, the diagrams here will help you understand. We already talked about the system. We talked about the source. My little sun. I made that myself. And then we talked about the wavelength discrimination or the wavelength selection part of this. That's the monochromator right here. This is a prism-based monochromator. What kind of mounting is that? Latrobe. Okay. So this is a Latrobe mount. Why? Because it's a reflecting prism. Never mind. Go back to sleep. Okay, so the light comes in. It goes through an entrance slit, right? Comes off of the mirror, goes off of into the Latrobe prism, gets dispersed into the wavelengths of light, comes out here to my focal plane. I've got an exit slit at the focal plane, and I rotate the prism back and forth, and I select the wavelength I want. And that goes on to my little photomultiplier tube. Yeah, I drew that too. I drew it all. I know, keep my day job. Okay, so I get the light at a particular wavelength that I want because I directed that wavelength onto the exit slit, and that went through the exit slit to the photomultiplier tube. So that's normal. That's a conventional way of doing things. If I want a spectrum, I put the prism on a stepper motor and I rotate it, okay, and I go from 200 nanometers to 800 nanometers and I get the complete spectrum. It takes me some time. Along comes image detectors. They came along before you were born. Not much before you were born, but they came along and they came up with this idea that if I put the detector, forget the exit slit, don't even need one, we'll just put the image detector right at the focal plane and I'll display the entire spectrum on the image detector. The first image detector was a piece of photographic film. Just put a piece of film in there, right? And the light coming off of the prism, the complete spectrum, is displayed across that piece of film. And if there's light at 400 nanometers, you get a bright spot at 400 and nothing at other wavelengths, okay? And so photographic film. And photographic film actually has pretty good resolution. Why? Because we want sharp pictures, you know, from our photographs. So I use black and white film typically, and you can use that as an image detector. But there's much better ways of doing it, okay, nowadays. This is the concept. Conventional versus image detector. All right. Whoops. Here's a very surreal-looking diagram. It's surreal because all of the components are floating in space, okay? And you can't do that, all right? But this is the deuterium source. Remember we hydrogen deuterium source? I had the one around. It had a funny-looking little box inside of there, metal box and so forth. Okay, light comes out, goes through a lens, shutter, your cuvette, okay? Lens, slit, whatever, and it hits the grating. Now it's all the entire, in this case, I have a device just like this downstairs in my lab. It was a photodiode array detector for HPLC. It uses a deuterium lamp. It had a flow cell in there. So the light passes through, all of the light goes through the sample and goes to the grating. The grating disperses it and then it shows you there in black and white. It shows you that the colors of the spectrum, which are dispersed here, let's say we'll call this 200 nanometers, and that's it, N, okay? And if this is a deuterium lamp, let's stick with the UV region, we'll say this is 350 nanometers, okay? My photodiode array, the first one I had, was only UV, and it only went from 180 to 370. And I still have it downstairs on the shelf, but we don't use it anymore. We got better ones. So it disperses that spectrum onto this thing called a photodiode array. Okay, right? It's a linear photodiode array. It's a whole bunch of little segments. Okay, maybe 512, maybe 1024. Okay, because it's an integrated circuit. It's basically an integrated circuit with a window. That's what it is. It's an integrated circuit with a window across the top of it, and it displays that spectrum. Okay, so remember that thing about the multiplex advantage that I told you about? Remember, I spent great length to describe to you the multiplex advantage. The fact that if we view all the signals at the same time, we're better off. If we measure them one at a time, by the time we get measuring the last one, we don't know what happened to the first one. We don't know if the conditions changed or something might have occurred during the course of me taking the spectrum. So when I take a conventional spectrum and I start at 200 nanometers and I begin scanning, it may take me minutes to get the complete spectrum done. Photodiode array, second, sub-second, okay, less than a second. The entire spectrum is measured by the computer that is connected to this integrated circuit that's measuring at all these different pixels, all these different diodes, okay, on this array of diodes, basically what it is. Okay, common image detectors. Remember I said before you were born, they made electron image detectors back in the, I don't know, 60s, okay? That was a long time ago, right? Electron image intensifiers were one of the first ones. Image dissectors, okay? And solid-state imaging devices such as Vidicon tubes, optical multi-channel analyzers, and then came photodiode arrays. Now, what we're doing as we go down this list is we're morphing from vacuum tube devices. You know, this is a vacuum tube, right? It's evacuated inside. There's some components in it. Well, a Vidicon was like a hybrid device. It was sort of a vacuum tube, but it was sort of a digital device. It had the capability of measuring digital signals. And optical multi-channel analyzers were more on the digital side, and photodiode arrays are digital devices. Image dissectors and electron image intensifiers were more vacuum tube type devices. We're not going to describe each one. I just want you to understand that there's different names out there that you might hear or see. Today, all you'll hear about are photodiode arrays and charge-coupled devices. Charge-coupled devices are everywhere. Everywhere. Most people are carrying one, right? Because your phone has a camera in it, and whether you like it or not. And that camera uses a charged-coupled device to measure the light, to measure the signals. So, these are what we'll use. Now, photo batteries are still used, and they're still good, but they're being edged out, pushed out by cheap charge-coupled devices. Okay, cheap and fairly sensitive charge-coupled devices. All right. Okay, these are all used with intensifiers. So sometimes if you're using them in a chemical application, like you want to measure signals from your instrument, you may need an intensifier. You may want to intensify the signal in order to increase the signal that you get, increase your sensitivity. Okay, here's some pretty pictures, courtesy of Hamamatsu. I didn't give them any credit here, but they make photomultiplier tubes. They also make various devices like this. Okay, we talked about photodiodes. There's one. Okay, there's one. They're little transistors. Now, transistors are probably before your time too, but the first digital electronic component was the transistor. That was a big deal. They used to talk about transistor radios. Okay, and because prior to that, everything was a vacuum tube radio. But they built a transistor radio. Transistors replaced the vacuum tubes. Transistor was a single device. It's like a single gate. You know what a gate is? You take any electronics? NAND, NOR, OR. You know about gates, right? No. Just nod your head. Okay, so what it is there's three leads, okay? It's a semiconductor device. I'll explain in just a minute. It measures, since a photodiode, we talked about, measures light, what you do is you put that photo cathode inside of this little bugger right here, okay? And the way this one is built, there's a little, see that little thing right there? It looks like a bubble on top. It's a lens. It's a little magnifying lens right on top of the photodiode, okay? And the light comes in and is magnified or focused. It's gathering light from a fairly wide numerical aperture, and it's focusing that light right onto the little photodiode that's giving you a signal. Professor Witten in chemistry, in PChem lab with the undergraduates, he builds little devices for them to make measurements using photodiodes and little cheap lasers, like the, you know, the little diode lasers that are in the laser pointer, things like that. Okay, so you can make these things, but it's a zero dimensional array. It's got one device. Okay, it measures light. It's not real sensitive. Then what I do is I decide, okay, I'm going to take a bunch of these and I'm going to line them up. Okay, I'm going to make a linear array, and that's what this is right here. Okay, this is a linear array of photodiodes all across. And remember, I told you it's an integrated circuit. It's like the chip. It's like the Pentium chip in your computer. It's just a chip that has a window on it, and of course it's got photosensitive material, and it's segmented into all these different addressable devices. Like I said, 512, 1024, connected to your computer. And the computer is able to measure the amount of light that's hitting each one of those arrays, each one of those diodes in the array. And so I display my light across the face of it, the 512 little, this is the same thing. This is my linear photodiode array, just like this is my linear photodiode array, okay? And then I plug that in with appropriate circuitry, and I hook it up with appropriate optics, and I display my light across the face of this, my spectrum right across the face of it, and I get the entire spectrum. Then I can go to two-dimensional arrays. So this is zero-dimensional, this is one-dimensional, and this is two-dimensional. So here I've got a little square, okay? And I've got diodes this way and that way, okay, two dimensions. I've got an array of them, and again, it might be, it might be 1024 by 768. It might be some number, you know, some number by some number. That's how we're gonna describe this two dimensional array, okay? Now, so these are all just different types of devices, different geometries, different operating conditions and parameters and so forth. Okay. What is you've probably heard, if you came to, we had a seminar last Wednesday, and they talked about organic semiconductors. And the big news, it's not really that big news, but Konarka, okay, the company Konarka. Konarka was is a spin-off company from this university, from this department. Chemistry and physics are involved, I guess, a little bit. But the idea there was a guy, Sukant Tripathi, who used to be here, he passed away. He had this idea. Wasn't a new idea. You know what they say. If you borrow ideas from somebody, that's plagiarism. So don't do it. But if you borrow ideas from lots of people, that's research. Okay. So what he did was he got this idea that we could make a device like a photo cell, a photovoltaic cell, but rather than just be a sheet, a plate that you put on your roof and get electricity, we'll make fabric out of it, and we'll make our clothes out of it. You know, Pierre Cardin, you know, Ralph Lauren. No. We'll make clothing out of it, and we'll clothe our military men with photovoltaic clothing. They'll be electronic people, okay? But they'll be able to power any of the devices, their radios, or any of the things that they have that they go into battle with. And we'll be able to use it in remote areas where people don't, we're off the grid, right? We have a grid of power in this country anyway, that power is supplied to all over the country, right? Well, there are remote areas where there is no power. So what do you do? What if you need to pump water out of a well, or need light, or whatever, and you live in a remote area? Well, we'll have these photovoltaics, okay? But they make flexible photovoltaics. And Konarka, the spin-off company, just announced that they actually have a product. 5 years, the company's been in existence, has come up with its first product. Its first product is a mat, a rubbery, flexible mat. It's a photovoltaic cell. Okay, it's a photovoltaic cell. You can wear it as a shawl, I guess. You know, put it on your head, make an umbrella out of it. Okay, put it on the roof of your car, whatever. But it's a flexible photovoltaic. How does it work? It works on the basis of semiconductors. So we had a seminar that talked about organic semiconductors. Most semiconductors are metals, and that's mainly the ones I know about. I don't know anything about this organic semiconductor stuff, but. So what is a semiconductor? It's something that conducts under one set of conditions and not under another set of conditions. So here's you take a piece of material. Usually it's silicon. Okay, that's a silicon wafer. That's the classic, okay, semiconductor material. That's what we make all of our electronic devices out of, most of our electronic devices out of them. It does not conduct electricity normally, but it can be made to conduct under certain conditions. So it's a semiconductor. Conducts under one set of conditions, not under another. So we bias it. What's that mean? We apply a voltage to it. We make the charges line up. We put a positive potential on one side, a negative potential on the other side. We make the charges migrate, okay? And what we have in the middle, okay, not only a junction, but as is shown down here, actually. So this is a non-biased semiconductor. This down here is biased. Okay, it's got reverse bias on it. I guess you put a positive charge on one side, the negative charges go over there. You put a negative charge on the other side, the positive charges go over there. And what do you got? You got a depletion layer in the middle. If there's no charges, there can be no conduction. It will not conduct if there's no charges. Now, because it's a reverse bias, it conducts when there's no power. So I shut the power off, the charges go back, and the thing can conduct electricity. I turn the power on, and the charges migrate, and I get a depletion layer, no conduction. So now I've got a signal, okay? It's an on-off signal, right? That's where I got into the NAND and the AND and the NOR gates, okay? Because there's circuit logic, right? So if I turn the power on, no conduction, zero. That's a zero state. if I turn the power off, I get a 1. The little semiconductor raises its hand. Okay? It says it's a 1. So you got a 1 and a 0 state, right? So this is binary. We can use binary with these semiconductors, and we can build computers. All right, we can build computers. Now there's a lot of building that goes on, and you can imagine that the people who came up with these ideas saying, "I got to put how many of these together to do anything? Okay, I got to put thousands of these gates together, these on-off semiconductor circuits, in order to make a device that would be a calculator or do anything, right?" But that's the way it works. Semiconductor materials. Now, what we're talking about is semiconductor materials that are triggered by light. So I put a bias on there, I get the depletion zone, I shine light on it, and what does it do? Here's the phrase. You ready? It promotes the electrons to the conduction band. Okay? It takes the electrons that are non-conducting, the material's non-conducting. I shine a light on it, I find a material that will do this. I shine a light on that material, the electrons get promoted, right? We know that spectroscopy, that's what it's all about. Light is absorbed, and the electrons, outer shell electrons, are promoted. If they're promoted to the right place, they're promoted into the conduction band. What's the conduction band? It's the region where the material will actually conduct electricity. So I've got a non-conducting material, biased, reverse bias, forward bias, whatever kind of bias you want to put on, whatever works, okay? We bias it, we get a depletion zone, we get no conductivity, we shine light on it, it promotes the electrons to the conduction band, and we see actual conductivity, all right? So now, I'm able to detect light with this semiconductor device, right? I can build computers with it, that's a different story. Now I want to build a device that detects light. Okay, so I use the right material that will undergo this type of process. That's a photodiode type process. A charged coupled device is very similar, okay, and I'll give you a brief description of it, but again, if you go to the handout materials, it's a little better described. A charged coupled device is a two-component device. It has, that's what the charged coupled, it's two devices coupled together. One of the devices measures the light, the other one stores the measured signal. Okay, that's the way these two work in tandem. So it shows you two devices here. It shows you light coming in, H nu, coming in. What does it do? It gives you an electron hole. In other words, an electron is moved out, and it leaves a positive charge where there's no electron. We'll call that an electron hole, a place where there's an electron missing. All right? If the light creates the electron hole, then we can collect those electron holes, those positive charges, transfer them to a storage device, and these are addressable devices. I might have a diagram. Yes. Okay. So what have I got? I've got a two-dimensional array of these devices that are addressable by a computer, right? It's connected to a circuitry to a computer. And as the light comes in and I create these electron holes and collect those electron holes, I transfer them to the storage device, and that's addressable by a register, by an addressing register. So the computer is able to tell me where the light hit. Now, why do I want to know where the light hit? Because I arrange this charge coupled device specifically with my optics so that certain wavelengths of light are hitting in certain places and other wavelengths of light are hitting in other places. And I'm able to tell this by my addressable behavior or ability of the charge coupled device. It's the same way that the charge coupled device in your cell phone takes a picture. It's a pretty crude device. Did you ever think of it? You know, the light's got to go in there. Got to go in that little hole. And it's thin. It's a thin telephone, you know. And somehow it takes that light and makes an image out of it. And the images aren't that bad. It's like a 3-megapixel device in this phone. 3 megapixels. That means that the two dimensions, okay, the number of devices across and down multiplied together is 3 million. three megapixels, right? So there's 3 million places on that array which light can be accessed and addressed by my dinky little telephone. All right. So this is a charge coupled device, and they're good devices for measuring light in an image type system. Let me mention quickly a photovoltaic cell. This is old passe stuff. You take a piece of conductor like iron, you slap a semiconductor over it, and maybe a thin layer of silver. Light comes through. It when the selenium semiconductor becomes conductive because of the light, an electron passes from the silver layer to the iron layer, and we get a current flowing in the system. That's how a photovoltaic works, right? So light excites electrons in the silicon, selenium, at the selenium-silver interface into the conduction band. There it is again, conduction band. And so then current flows to the metal conductor. These work okay, but only for high light levels, and they're subject to fatigue. They get tired, okay? Why do they get tired? They get enough sleep. No, light comes in, and it basically depletes the material of electrons after a while. It depletes the material of usable electrons. And so now there's no power required to run this thing. It generates the power on its own. It takes light energy and converts that to power. Here's an example of one that I pulled out of a Chemical and Engineering News. And they've got, what do they got? They got a piece of glass, light coming through. They got indium tin oxide as their semiconductor, and they got a wire attached to that. Then they got a thin film of a fullerene, you know, Buckminster fullerene, and I don't know, I forget what that has some advantage. And then they got aluminum on the bottom, which is the conductor. Okay, so their semiconductor, same deal, same thing as I showed you in the previous diagram. All right. There's another type of device called a photoconductive detector. Very similar, except now I'm going to apply a voltage to the system, okay? So it's a semiconductor with a voltage applied across it, and when the electrons are promoted to the conduction band, there it is again, okay? When the electrons get into the conduction band, then we get current flowing in the system because of the voltage that I applied. And so this doesn't have the fatigue problem that the photovoltaic does. The photovoltaic doesn't use power, it generates power. This uses power and just tells you, based on the level of conductivity, how much light is impinging upon the surface of this semiconductor device. You can make them out of lead sulfide, lead selenide, indium antimonide. I just make this stuff up. It's good for long wavelengths of light, okay, the near-infrared region. Not so good for what we want to do. Germanium, activated with copper, gold, zinc, good for, okay, so this is different wavelengths of light. It has to be operated at 5 degrees K. That could be tough. Less sensitive than photomultiplier tubes, but better than thermal detectors in IR. What are you talking about, thermal detectors in IR? We'll talk about those in a minute. I mentioned photographic detection. Place a film at a focal plane and expose it to light. So you put the film in there. You get good resolution. It's fairly sensitive and it covers the entire spectral region. Of course, it's a very old technique. Film is difficult to deal with. You got to develop it. You can't be quantitatively used, you know. It's pretty bad quantitative. You have to use a densitometer, a light table, and look at how much light goes through the little spots on your film. Not a good way to do things. But these are all image detectors, right? Photographic, photoconductive, photovoltaic, charge-coupled device, photodiode array. All will give you images or pictures. Hey, we like pictures, okay? We'll give you images of the system. It could be two-dimensional, a linear photodiode, or it could be, it could be a linear one-dimensional array or a two-dimensional array that'll give you a picture, or a zero-dimensional, which is a just a single device. Okay, we need to talk about thermal detectors for IR. I'm clearly not going to get this finished, but let me just give you a couple of minutes here. Just give me a couple of minutes, okay? thermal detectors. We don't have enough energy in the IR region to generate photoelectrons from the photoelectric effect. We need to come up with a way to measure infrared radiation. Infrared is heat, right? So we have thermal detectors. I'm going to tell you about three kinds of thermal detectors, okay? They something absorbs the infrared radiation and temperature increases. The problem is the response time is fairly slow because the heat has to transfer and warm something up, and they're also fairly their sensitivity is poor. They have fairly poor sensitivity. So we got some problems, but what are we going to do? If we want to do infrared and there's valuable information in the infrared region of the spectrum, then we got to come up with a system. So I'm going to give you three types of thermal detectors. Okay, the first one is a thermocouple. A thermocouple is the most common one. You can build the thermocouple yourself. You take two pieces of dissimilar metal and twist them together. When I was a student, we did this in PChem lab. We took nickel, constantin, some alloy, and we twisted these two wires together, and you stuck one in an ice bath and one in a, you know, boiling water, and you could measure the temperature differences and just by the amount of voltage, okay, the potential that developed. So you want to make it a good thermal detector. You paint it black because black absorbs everything. You take the junction, you make a junction between two dissimilar metals, you paint it black, and you measure the voltage across that develops at that interface or at that junction. So voltage difference across the junction is a function of temperature. You got to amplify the signal because it's a pretty low signal. It's millivolts kind of range, maybe even lower. The response time is pretty slow. Remember, we're talking nanoseconds before. Now we're talking 60 milliseconds. Okay, not microseconds, okay? We jumped, how many orders of magnitude is that? About 8 orders of magnitude we lost in response time going from a photomultiplier tube to a thermocouple, all right? The sensitivity is greater if you use a thermopile. What's a thermopile? It's a pile of thermocouples. Okay, a bunch of thermocouples clumped together is called the thermopile. And you get better sensitivity. Okay, the second type of thermal detector in IR is a bolometer. A bolometer is the same thing as a thermistor. What's a thermistor? A thermistor is a resistor. Okay, yeah, it is. A thermistor is a resistor. So in the other case, in thermocouple, we were making voltage by heat. Okay, now we're just changing the resistance of a substance by heat. Well, pretty much everything that conducts electricity will change its resistance as you change its temperature. Some things have a better sensitivity than others, so you pick the ones you want. Nickel, platinum oxides, it says here metal or oxides, nickel oxide, cobalt oxide, manganese oxide. All these substances will change their conductivity in a usable range, change their resistance. Yeah, conductivity is the inverse of resistance, I guess. So it's the same thing. Will change their resistance based on their temperature. You put them all together, maybe again you paint them black, and you put a black coating on them. Now a lot of oxides, some of these oxides are black anyway. You put a heat shield around them because you want to shield them. You put a heat shield around because you don't want them to get heat from the room. You want them to get heat just from your light source coming through. You connect them to a bridge circuit. I mentioned the bridge circuit in here once before, and everybody gave me the blank stare, so I won't bother going into that again. But a bridge circuit is a circuit that balances, in this case, resistances. So my thermistor has a resistance. I compare that with a standard resistor, and when I get no current flowing in the system, the two are completely balanced, and I know exactly what the resistance of my thermistor is. Remember, a thermistor is a resistor. Okay. Johnson noise is important because Johnson noise was the thermal motion of electrons in the load resistor. You forgot that already? I just talked about that a few minutes ago. Okay. And you need a stable power supply for this because you do have to put power through it in order to show what the resistance is. All right. So we got a thermocouple that will measure infrared radiation. We got a bolometer, which is a thermistor, which measures resistance. Two different principles: potential versus resistance. The last one is the Golay pneumatic detector. But let's see, where am I going? Okay, I'll tell you about that next class. All right, I got a few more slides. I'll tell you about the next class, and then we'll be done with material for the exam. And the exam will be the 28th. We have a class Friday. We have class next week, but are we showing up for class next week, or are we all skipping? Okay, but you're still responsible for the material. If it snows, 8 feet of snow, and you can't get it, you're still responsible. Okay, it'll all be on the internet. All right? So we'll talk about that more, but I'll have a lecture up on the internet for you for the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, so you don't have to come here. Okay, you can just get up with your pajamas on, and you can turn on the computer, and then you can, and I'll be in the background going, wah, 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 wah. Okay? That's it. Oh, I forgot to hand this around. This is a charge couple device. This is a mini spectrometer. There's a on a board. There's the charge couple device with a little lens in front of it, and there's a grating over here, and you can take a look at that if you'd like. And we're done.